Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way, flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire.
In this episode, Dr. Caitlin Harvey maps out land transfers from Indigenous communities to European education institutions through a map of New Zealand's colonial university.
Depicting the North Island of Aotearoa, New Zealand, a vast map outlines the lands that surround the Kimihia and Hakanoa lakes. Small plots of land, 50 acres each, are demarcated and assigned to various landholders. Running parallel to these plots is the Waikato River, the map's westernmost feature. Along its eastern edge are most of the demarcated plots, each one named and numbered for an intended buyer or lessee. Names like Jackson or McKinley fill the map, creating a patchwork of named block-shaped properties. But the map's largest feature, hundreds of acres in size, is labeled Endowment for Colonial University. Such a substantial block of land would not only have been greater than the size of a university's campus, but this land was also located in the Waikato, hundreds of miles away from Christchurch, which was the main site of New Zealand's colonial university. Produced in 1873, the map before us was sent from the Registrar of the University of New Zealand to the Office of New Zealand's Colonial Secretary. At this time, New Zealand was a British settler colony, its official status confirmed with the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi between the British Crown and Maori chiefs in 1840. New settler governments, like the one in New Zealand, hoped to build churches, schools, and other social institutions to cement their connection to the lands they occupied. Yet they were cash poor. What this map depicts, then, is the mechanism through which certain settler governments, including those in New Zealand, raised new universities' endowment capital. Legislators supplied new institutions of higher education with enormous tracts of expropriated Indigenous lands. These lands, often located very far away from the institutions themselves, could be leased or sold to raise money for universities' endowments. We often think of universities as distinctive place-based communities. Students might nostalgically associate their alma mater with a particular location, usually its host city or campus. In fact, possibly the longest-lasting myth of the land-grant university is that its operations existed in one fixed place. This map of the University of New Zealand's endowment lands thus challenges our popular understanding of universities' fixedness by revealing the broad territorial reach of higher education institutions. At the same time, it exposes university building as one tool of imperial expansion and how higher education was funded through the sometimes violent seizure of Indigenous lands in the 19th century. At the time of this map's creation, settlements in Aotearoa, New Zealand were a part of the wider British Empire. Like other colonies of settlement, especially those in Canada and the United States, colonial administrators relied upon legislative grants of Indigenous land to generate endowment capital. Most land transfer from Maori tribes to European occupiers took place between 1840 and 1890. Not coincidentally, this was also these islands' most significant period of development in higher education. The longer New Zealand Wars, from 1845 to 1872, fought primarily for control of the North Island, occurred in tandem with the colonial state's redistribution of Maori lands to university institutions. During these wars, New Zealander officials, backed by colonial officials in Melbourne, assigned Maori land reserves to institutions yet to exist. The University Endowments Act, for instance, set aside 10,000 acres of confiscated land in the province of Taranaki in 1868, while what is known as Tito Kawaru's War still raged. Much of this land would be secured by violence, retained, and then transferred to the University of New Zealand, the same university as represented on our map, and later also to Auckland University College. The University of Otago began the process of redistribution, receiving at least 200,000 acres, and during the City of Dunedin's gold rush, university officers sold timber and gold prospecting rights on acquired lands. Land rents alone did not sustain the institution in perpetuity, in part because of fluctuating land values, yet these funds gave the university a permanent foothold in colonial society. Taken together, this land redistribution amounted to an incredible wealth transfer from Indigenous communities to universities. New universities, like the University of New Zealand, which was established in 1870 and disestablished in 1961, thus benefited from and contributed to processes of imperial expansion and Indigenous dispossession. The pattern of institutional development described, however, was not unique to New Zealand. Other colonies of settlement once within, or formerly within, the British Empire, especially Canada and the United States, but also Australia and South Africa, similarly relied upon Indigenous land to fund higher education. Educationalists within these places communicated with one another, usually through letters and colonial newspapers, and compared institutional funding models. Intercolonial learning was central to the spread of this form of institutional financing. Settlers who were oceans apart faced similar challenges, from being cash poor to attracting students, and drew upon imperial networks to overcome them. By the 19th century, the relationship between universities and landholding was long-standing. In England, the universities of Oxford and Cambridge had long relied on the rental income generated by landholding. Even today, the Oxbridge colleges are among the largest institutional landholders in land-scarce England. Settler societies followed this example, but applied it on a larger and more devastating scale. As early as 1619, the British government assigned 10,000 acres to endow a Henrico College in Virginia in the United States. Warfare with the Powhatan Confederacy, an Indigenous alliance of Algonquian-speaking peoples, and chronic underpopulation ensured that this institution was short-lived. In 1846, the U.S. government released to Tennessee 1.3 million acres of public land for the endowment of a college. This land, nearly the size of Delaware, was supposedly vacant and unappropriated, but only after the violent removal of the Cherokee peoples. The largest single grant of land made for higher education came in 1862. The American Morrill Act supplied almost 11 million acres for a land-grant university in each state that would provide education in agriculture and the mechanic arts. This was more land than exists in the states of Vermont, Connecticut, and Delaware combined. Meanwhile, in British North America, one of the earliest educational land grants went to King's College, a precursor to the University of Toronto. In 1828, an Anglican clergyman, the Bishop John Strawn, secured 226,000 acres of valuable crown reserves for the new college. Much of this property likely once supported the Mississaugas of New Credit First Nations. Again, in the 1870s, Manitoba's provincial government endowed its new university with 150,000 acres of recently dispossessed Indigenous land. Although provincial legislators offered to select lands on the institution's behalf, university administrators insisted that their own, quote, miniature land department would best serve their interests. This land board served as a type of land bank, offering loans to agriculturalists using its collateral, securing mortgages, and relying on land agents to rent or sell property on favorable terms. Among settler societies in the Southern Hemisphere, educationalists in South Africa and Australia did not initially require institutional funding via land. While South African universities received various pockets of land, including land gifts from Cecil Rhodes and other mining magnates, gold profits were first used to sustain universities. In South Africa, successive wars of Dutch and British colonizers against the Khoikhoi, San, Zulu, and Xhosa peoples had dispossessed them of these gold-producing lands. Meanwhile, the gold rushes of the 1850s in New South Wales and Victoria in Australia had invigorated government revenue streams and enriched mine owners, who eventually passed on some of that wealth to endow universities. Land granting across Australia varied considerably by institution. Certain universities, such as the University of Adelaide in 1874, received substantial land endowments as financing. By contrast, government officials in New Zealand used land as a financing tool for nearly all of their colonial universities. Taken together, the lands held by these settler universities amounted to over 15 million acres spread across three continents. That amount of land was four times the area of all Maori land confiscated during the New Zealand Wars, or three times the size of Wales, even excluding those properties held temporarily. This particular map of lands held by the University of New Zealand is thus one significant piece of a larger imperial and global puzzle. Maps are not neutral artworks or historical documents that can be viewed uncritically. We can understand this map as both a tool of colonial expansion as well as a representation of a particular place from the mapmaker's point of view. In addition, the University of New Zealand's map, which was sent to New Zealand's colonial secretary, was also contained within a larger packet of correspondence on potential university lands. The purpose of this correspondence was most likely to facilitate the selection and transfer of Maori lands to the university. The registrar's map, therefore, doesn't just reflect the outcome of an imperial project, it also helped to realize that project, becoming more and more real as the lands it depicts were later leased and sold. Maps like this one also enable us to reconsider the territorial reach of universities, which held lands in disparate locations distant from them. At the same time, it exposes educational institutions as one of the less obvious mechanisms through which empires sustained their influence. The historian Bobby Lee and journalist Tristan Atone have similarly engaged in understanding universities in this way. They exhaustively trace the story of American public universities, quote, built not just on Indigenous land, but with Indigenous land, in their fascinating Land Grab Universities project. Likewise, the historian Craig Stephen Wilder has followed the interaction between America's private Ivy League universities, slavery, and Indigenous peoples. He argues that universities were, quote, imperial instruments, akin to armories and forts, a part of the colonial garrison. In comparison with these American stories, relatively little has been said of the New Zealand case or of institutional landholding within other British colonies of settlement. We can thus profitably expand our frame to consider university land granting as a wider pattern of development. In addition to controlling territory, landholding universities also attempted to control knowledge production about land. They made available the teachings of scientific agriculture from Europe, while also producing their own contributions to agricultural technologies and knowledge. This work did not serve all societal groups equally. While the process occurred unevenly, universities institutionalized one form of knowledge about land cultivation, while leaving aside Indigenous ways of being and thinking about land. Products of university agricultural research, like hybridized corn and nitrogen fertilizers, would profoundly transform landscapes. These inventions also popularized the university for its practical utility and entrenched settlers' relationship to the land, actions that have had lasting political and ecological legacies. The University of New Zealand Registrar's Map, sent in May 1873, should be considered as one artwork in a larger series. The university created other maps for other lands it held, and almost all land-grant universities mapped out their holdings. These maps were powerful tools for visualizing and monetizing Indigenous lands. Both land speculators and settlers relied upon them to generate contracts with university officials, and as such, they are one of the most important records we have to show the financial transactions that generated educational funding. Today, these maps also compel their viewers to hold the progressive narrative of university building side by side with its counterpart, the story of Indigenous dispossession that made that progressivism possible. Financed through land grabs, land-grant universities were no small piece of the process of Indigenous dispossession. Such maps thus bring into view one piece of a larger colonial past, one that extends into the present.
Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofroniewicz. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.